Hello, listeners. You're probably wondering what the heck is going on. It's an off week, and yet we've got an episode coming through. So what's all this about? Well, Brian, I've got this connection with the podcast called Sex Evangelicals, and I thought it might be worth letting others that listen to our show listen to their show.
Well, we do love a bit of sex. Less evangelical stuff, but love sex.
We do, just not with each other. They are a couple of sex therapists who are ex-evangelicals themselves, who have basically put together this podcast to deal with sex. And so if you have been presented with this idea of intense monogamy and purity culture and things like that, they try to unpack all those kinds of things. And so I thought it'd be really good to introduce this to our listeners.
Well, I think they're going to love it. And because I think that demystification of sex, I mean, it was made so bloody complex, wasn't it, when we were in fundamentalism. So this is a great episode for people to listen to and hear a little bit more about how you can actually be freed up from some of that baggage that you may still be hanging on to.
Yeah, exactly right. So instead of just giving you an ad or telling you about it, we thought, let's play a whole episode. So go ahead and listen. And if you're into them, all the links to connect with Sex Evangelicals as a podcast and to add to your playlist will all be in the show notes. So let's have a listen, shall we, Brian?
Let's have a listen.
Hey, this is Julia.
Hey, this is Jeremiah.
Welcome to Sex Evangelicals, the podcast about the sex education the church didn't want you to have. Hosted by us, two licensed and certified sex therapists.
Welcome to the first official episode of our new series, The Sex Ed We Wish We Had. In this series, we'll be exploring each of the six sexual health principles outlined in the work of Doug Brown Harvey and Michael Vigorito. Today's episode is about the first sexual health principle, consent.
Unlike what we learned in Sunday school, the legally binding contract of marriage is not the symbol of consent forever and ever. Amen.
Amen. In so many ways, the Christian wedding ceremony is one big sexual innuendo or euphemism.
Absolutely. Since departing from institutionalized Christianity, I now find the church's obsession with the wedding night, read religiously sanctioned sexual debut, preferably between two virgins or born-again virgins, to be both invasive and bizarre.
I can totally relate to you. Also, virgins, I kind of cringed a little.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
What made you cringe?
Just as you and I have moved out of evangelical circles, just being mindful of the language that's so core to how people get identified within evangelical circles around whether or not they've had sex.
Yes, we can have a whole other episode in the future about virginity being a social construct. Ugh. The church loves to define people by in-groups and out-groups, and one in-group and out-group is the virgin group or the non-virgin
right.
group, the pure or the impure.
Right.
Anyway, not the topic for today specifically. Going back to the topic at hand, which is the bizarre obsession with honeymoon sex and wedding night sex, which is such a big deal in Christian communities.
Yeah.
Like a really big
deal.
When I got married at the way too young age of 22, the last song at my wedding reception was "Tonight's Gonna Be a Good Night" by the Black Eyed Peas.
Oh God.
And all of our friends implicitly or explicitly during this last song and dance referred to the pending wedding night and honeymoon sex. Spoiler alert, neither went well for me.
Julia, I'm really, really sorry to hear about that. What's it like to reflect on that now?
Part of me wants to laugh because it is genuinely funny. There is a book called Stuff Christians Like, and one of the chapters has a bit about the desperate hope of young Christians that Jesus' second coming will be after their honeymoon, so of course they can have their religiously sanctioned sexual debut.
So accurate to Christian purity culture.
I'm also super sad when I reflect on this, because the assumption that marriage and the celebration of your wedding serves as a symbol of consent is such a sexual health failure.
Yeah, I know, Julia, you and I are not alone in our attempts to unlearn the sex negative messages from the church and relearn new ways of navigating our relationships.
So this episode is for you if, like us, you did not learn the relational skills to negotiate sexual experiences with partners. And even if you did have some formal sex education in a public school or from a secular source, chances are you probably did not learn about consent outside of don't sexually assault people or other legal markers of avoiding rape allegations, which is not the same as the ongoing relational process of consent.
That's right. I'm really glad that you made that distinction, and we'll talk more about that distinction in this episode. I'm also thinking even more tragically, Julia, about you may not have learned what actually constitutes as assault and other non-consensual sexual experiences.
I was a practicing therapist for over 3 years before I had the language to describe multiple experiences for exactly what they were, which was abuse, assault, and violation. On that traumatic note, today's episode on consent is not about situations that involve assault as an intentional abuse of power. We will be diving into the much murkier and more complicated territory about what happens when folks don't have the tools to practice consent by negotiating with partners about wants, needs, and desires in the sexual experiences which they pursue. That is oh so common for evangelical and recovering evangelical folks. One outcome we see is the development of non-consensual sexual experiences rooted in ignorance and lack of education rather than in intentional abuse of power. Those are the scenarios that we will be describing on our episode today.
So with that framework, Julia, here's what to expect from today's episode. We'll start by defining consent, because a huge value of ours is having a shared definition. We'll briefly explore the status of consent with both Christian and secular communities.
And we've already essentially defined that within Christian culture. The status of consent within Christian culture is that you get married and in front of all the most important people in your life, you kiss, exchange rings, say your vows, and then for the next 3 to 5 hours or however long your wedding reception is, everybody will make snide remarks about how you can now have sex and you're just going to bang all night long. I think I summarized that part of the episode
Tune in next time. No. What else are we going to do today, Julia?
We will share some of our own stories around consent in non-abusive experiences. Mm-hmm. This was a doozy of an episode to prepare. Complicated territory. Stay with us.
And finally, we'll close with some relationship 101 as to how you and your partner can be more intentional about talking about the sexual experiences that you want to have together. Shall we begin?
One other quick note before we move into the definition. Typically in this podcast, we have important criticism to the religious structures that have wreaked all kinds of harm and havoc in its sexual messaging and policies. However, in this episode, we will give a huge shout out to a Christian school in Ohio who was far ahead of its time in developing a model for consent in the 90s. So that's exciting for us. First time.
First time we've spoken positively about the church in the 90s on this podcast episode.
So stay tuned. All right, moving into definitions. When we discuss consent today and in the future, we will use the definition from the Harvey Institute. This is also the perfect opportunity to plug our 2 episodes with Doug Brown Harvey, who has been a leader in the sexual health space for several decades, and most importantly, is a gem of a human being. Check out those 2 episodes.
So here's the definition of consent from the Harvey Institute. Consent means voluntary cooperation and communicates permission to try and reach sexual satisfaction and intimacy with willing partners. Consent transforms the act of sex from invasion, intrusion, or violation into an act of transformation. Establishing consent throughout each step of a sexual interaction provides each sexual partner space for sexual safety and pleasure that's consistent with their sexual desires.
Love that definition. The first thing that I notice is that consent is an interactive relational dynamic rather than something asked for and then given or refused. Jeremiah, how does this definition hold up to the status of consent in culture writ large?
It's very different because historically speaking, consent, as I and many other people have learned, was a principle rooted in avoiding negative legal repercussions, which is actually very similar to what the church teaches. To be blunt and dark, consent in our country has been about folks, primarily men, getting as far as they can sexually while escaping rape allegations or charges. Similarly to the church, American culture has given women the responsibility of gatekeeping men's sexuality while keeping themselves safe from violence.
That's such an important point, Jeremiah. So often the Christian church establishes themselves as countercultural. However, in terms of sexuality, the status of so many sexual health principles are quite similar within and outside of church walls.
Right.
We have long taught women best practices for avoiding assault. Even now, dialogue is slowly, very slowly, moving in a more just direction. However, we have still failed to teach men that the practice of consent is intended for the pursuit of pleasure for all involved parties, rather than ensuring that you don't get sued, because that would look bad on your resume.
I love the idea, Julia, that consent is a proactive practice of communication for the goal of pleasure. So proactive in communication, it's an ongoing process. And the goal, the outcome, is pleasure. And we'll talk about this in a later episode. Mutual pleasure, which is what we mean when we say affirmative consent.
We'll come back to this multiple times throughout the episode. If you only learn one thing from today, please learn that consent is the proactive negotiation of pleasure. But first, Jeremiah, you shared information with me recently that was totally new on the origins of affirmative consent. Despite the slowness of society to catch on to this concept, a religious university in Ohio was the first to develop a model for affirmative consent. Tell us more about that. I've never been more excited about religious schools in Ohio. Never.
The process of affirmative consent, which was developed through the sexual offense prevention policy at Antioch College in Ohio in the early 90s, contains seven characteristics.
Let's name the seven characteristics briefly.
Okay.
Number one, explicitness. A yes must be expressed verbally. Silence is not consent.
Number two, voluntariness. The yes must be given voluntarily, without pressure or coercion.
Ability to consent is number three. Intoxicated people, people under a certain age, are unable to give consent. Multiple other factors could impact the ability to consent as well. Anything that gets in the way of your ability to consent moves the experience from consensual to non-consensual.
Number four, a shift of responsibility. So by that, they mean the person who initiates the sexual act has the responsibility to obtain consent of all participants in non-coercive ways. I love that particular one because we're thinking now about sexuality as a relational dynamic. And in any sort of dynamic, there's an initiator, there's a receiver. And the initiator has certain roles, the receiver has certain roles. I love the fact that they name this is the role of the initiator in this particular interaction.
To very nicely scaffold onto that, number five is freedom from presumption. Consent must be obtained repeatedly for each new sexual act.
Number six, informedness. All participants must know what consent is being given for in particular. When we think about the role of the receiver, what would it be like to have a sexual experience where the initiator says, hey, this is what I want to kind of work through, and the receiver has some sort of process of repeating back or reflecting back. Oh, so are you talking about this? This sounds like a good idea. Or, no, don't do this. Or, how about we do this instead?
Great. Number 7, the final one, revocability. A previously given consent can be withdrawn at any time. Wow. Jeremiah, I am so glad you found this information. Frankly, I was shocked to learn that a religious school in Ohio was the first to develop this model. I am always amazed, sometimes horrified, as was the case with the Me Too movement, that seemingly current social justice concerns typically have roots decades prior to when they emerge into the national narrative. Often initially expressed by a person or group with a marginalized identity.
As was the case with Me Too.
Right. That is another conversation for another time. But wow, how progressive. Jeremiah, what stands out to you as we read through the list of the consent principles?
Yeah, as I mentioned before, what stands out to me is that consent requires proactive, intentional communication. Yes, of course, consent involves body language, tone, relational history, other contextual factors. But first and foremost, consent requires a conversation. In the best case scenario, before, during, and after the sexual experiences. What stands out to you, Julia?
What is standing out to me right now is actually a bit of a dilemma. And this whole episode is just full of dilemmas for me.
Well, talk to us about the dilemma that you're currently working through.
We read these 7 principles as clear, accurate, and concise. Mm-hmm. However, consent is actually very complicated.
Yeah.
Even in more progressive circles, I've noticed this impulse to try and make consent as simple as possible. And I've got some theories for why this is. But you're right, we actually have so many different contextual factors to take into account with each sexual scenario, with each of the 7 principles. We can't actually package consent into a simple formula. This is especially true when we consider these amazing principles within the broader context of what we know from the field of sexual health.
What do you mean?
I'll give one example. So, for example, we actually know that eroticism thrives within ambiguity, or another way to say it is the not knowing of exactly what might occur within a sexual experience.
Sure.
Which, to some degree, actually contradicts one of the principles that you just mentioned.
Sure.
I'll give an anecdote from my own life. As I shared with you, Jeremiah, if someone asks me directly, "Do you want to have sex?" which would be a great way to practice consent, that is actually a turnoff for me because it ruins the ambiguity. I like to be teased, I like to be seduced, which is a bit tricky when consent also involves clear agreement about what to expect sexually. I could give so many other examples of why consent isn't always that clear, which makes it all the more essential to discuss. If it were as easy as those 7 principles in isolation, we might not need to have this episode. Now, don't mishear me. We can definitely practice consent with all of these 7 principles while still leaving space for mystery and seduction and other elements of sexuality that make consent just not so neat and tidy.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Julia. And as we're talking about this more and as you're listening to this, I want to keep in mind the distinctions between a legal perspective of consent and a relational health perspective of consent.
Yes.
And the similarities, the differences, the nuances, really appreciate the way that you and that we are setting this up. In later episodes, we'll explore some of the specific complexities that you named.
Yes. I recognize that in sharing what I shared, I opened a bit of Pandora's box.
Sure.
And the purpose of today's episode is not actually to explore those specific murky areas. My only point is that consent is hard. Consent is actually not particularly easy or packageable.
Hmm.
And at the same time, just as I'm considering how complicated consent is, I'm also considering how super basic it is.
Tell me more about what you mean by that.
Not necessarily basic in terms of simple, but basic in terms of foundational. Consent is about negotiating a sexual experience and talking.
Yeah.
Being able to talk about sex is necessary in order to navigate the trickier elements of consent and sexuality. And furthermore, being able to talk about sex is essential for all the other sexual health principles we'll be discussing in the next several episodes. We can't talk about mutual pleasure or prevention of STI or honesty unless we're actually talking, and consent is about talking.
Yeah.
Again, this isn't easy and it is necessary.
Yeah. Another factor to consider in this episode today that often gets missed by legal and human resources departments is the power differentials that can exist in sexual relationships. For example, in heterosexual relationships, power differentials exist related to gender, particularly as it pertains to socialization around engagement in sexuality.
Now, both of us were previously in heterosexual relationships. Mm-hmm. So in discussing the power differentials related to consent today, we'll be focusing on the heterosexual dynamic.
Yeah.
That being said, obviously power differentials exist in all relationships for all different kinds of reasons. And this is one more dilemma in the consent episode.
Sure.
This is not just an entire series on its own. This is an entire other podcast.
Yeah.
So our scope of the episode today has some limitations.
Sure.
And we are going to be speaking from those experiences today and using our own stories, which primarily concern the power differentials around consent in hetero relationships specific to gender. Okay, so Jeremiah, could you actually speak more to what you mean when you say power differentials in hetero relationships?
Yeah, so when we're talking about power differentials in opposite sex relationships. Again, Julia, as you said, we only have time to scratch the surface. Another word that gets thrown around is heteronormativity. Heteronormativity relies on narratives about how men and women enact sexuality differently. Inside the church, as we talked about in the Reading the Butler series and in the Seven Deadly Sexual Sins, according to the church, but also outside of the church, we have the false narrative that men are inherently more sexual, and that women have the duty to perform sexuality according to the socialized norms of what men crave sexually.
Classic heteronormativity. Wendy Holloway, author of the book Changing the Subject, Psychology, Social Regulation, and Subjectivity, names two key processes rooted in heteronormativity that feed the idea of sexual compliance. Essentially, a person says yes, maybe even a verbal yes, but may not want to participate in the sexual activity. Jeremiah, what are the two processes that Holloway names?
The first one she labels as the male sexual drive discourse. And this is one that we were reminded is alive and well when we were reading Josh Butler's Beautiful Union the last few weeks. Male desire is a dominant driving force upheld by the lie that women have lower sex drives, and as such are put in the roles of gatekeeper, limiting and controlling male desire and sexuality. The second one she calls the have and hold discourse, in which sex is used as a way to keep or stabilize a relationship. A common example of this is women are socialized to utilize sexual attractiveness and satisfaction to keep their relationship alive.
Ugh. When you shared this resource with me, my stomach dropped initially because I can relate so heavily to both of those norms in every relationship of my life, but particularly in my marriage. I'll share more about my experience in a bit. Jeremiah.
Does this mean I get to go first?
You sure do. Ugh. Jeremiah, how did this play out in the relationship with your ex-wife?
As you mentioned earlier, in the Christian church, consent is given once at the altar on the wedding day, And thereafter, the assumption is that sex is a regular part of the relationship without negotiation or conversation.
And in many Christian communities, most, if not all, sexual experiences that a person or a couple has prior to marriage is a sin. Therefore, the sin nature of the experience before getting married would equally prevent dialogue, aside from seeking repentance. So I only mention that to say that folks within those Christian communities are doomed on both ends of the spectrum.
Sure.
The sin narrative keeps the couple or the group from talking about sex before getting married.
Right.
And then after getting married, the idea that the altar is consent then prevents dialogue moving forward.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Totally. Totally. Okay. Let's talk about how that gets played out then in my relationship with my ex. Before marriage, and I've mentioned this before in the podcast, but for those of you who are new to the show, my early sexual experiences with my ex, all premarital, were almost always followed by some sort of what I would later learn was a panic attack. This occurred while we were dating, and due to the shame of premarital sexual experiences, these initially pleasurable experiences very quickly turned into shame, anxiety, and ultimately panic.
Oh, that is so heartbreaking. You didn't have the language to even identify those experiences.
I didn't. I only knew that A, I wanted to have, and I think that my ex wanted to have some variety of sexual experience, and B, that following a sexual experience, my ex would weep, shake, and apologize profusely, and that I would hold her because I had no idea what was going on.
Oh, the apologizing profusely stands out because, once again, that's a way she played into the narrative of being the gatekeeper for the sexuality
right.
of the relationship.
Right.
Oh, so sad for both of you. Then you got married. So what was your experience moving into religiously sanctioned sexuality without the essential tools for any sexual relationship?
This is pretty hard to talk about. For the first year, I would say that we talked about sex okay. I typically initiated questions about sex and if she wanted to have sex. Sometimes she'd say yes. Sometimes she'd criticize me and say something like, all you think about is sex, or something equally sex-shaming. I'd say the first year it was 50% I got a good response when I initiated, 50% I got a critical response. By the second year, those numbers shifted to about 20-80.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. That must have reinforced everything that you learned about men being dangerous sexual creatures.
Absolutely.
Who simultaneously had to fight this part of themselves and also embrace it because, as we learned, men are just designed to be sexual aggressors. I say sexual aggressors and not initiators because that was the language I learned. Men are sexual aggressors.
Sure, and that was not something that I remember hearing, but it's definitely something that I learned through osmosis.
Sure.
So I wanted to go to couples therapy with my ex, but she refused. So 27-year-old Jeremiah is left in a double bind. I either practice sexuality in an overtly consensual way and expose myself to a growing amount of criticism about sexuality, which, by the way, had morphed by year three, let's say, into criticism about my work, the ways that I didn't spend enough time with her, and other parts of my personhood. Or I find more passive ways to initiate sexuality, all with the understanding that, one, divorce is off the table because I'm a good Christian person at this point, and two, sexuality was mine to initiate due to gendered scripts.
I want to come back to what you mentioned about passive ways of initiating sex in just a moment. However, something that I'm considering for the first time in this moment is the way that you're describing the criticism about sexuality morphing into these other parts of who you are as a person.
Sure.
Particularly your career. Your career is an important part of your identity.
Absolutely.
So whenever we talk about sex, we are talking about far more than what we do or don't do with our genitalia.
Absolutely.
And I'll talk more about my experience in a bit. my challenges with sexuality influenced in a negative way every single part of mm-hmm. who I was. Mm-hmm. So the criticism about your sexuality, if it were in isolation, would be hurtful enough.
Sure.
But that criticism about sex was ultimately a criticism about your humanity.
Absolutely.
Oh, I am so, so sorry. Thank We're going to come back to that a little bit later.
Oh,
so
boy.
Put that one on the back burner. Put Great. It from boil to simmer.
Great. It's simmering.
Okay. So tell us what you mean when you say that you then developed more passive ways of initiating sex.
Yeah, we had an implicit understanding that Saturday mornings were designated for our sexual experiences. So typically, I would wake up first, cuddle her, read the New York Times while she slept. And when I knew she was awake, we'd say good morning, and I would, a few 10, 15 minutes after, initiate sex by kissing her, making out with her. And we would move into a sexual experience without any sort of explicit agreements about what we both wanted, without communication during the experience, and certainly without any sort of aftercare that included any debrief or follow-up about what worked or what didn't work.
So rather than having conversations about your sexual relationship and what would be pleasurable for both of you, you relied on a sexual script that allowed you to avoid criticism and rejection without actually asking your ex-wife if it was working for her and without talking about your own desires.
Right, because talking about sexuality would have put me in the double bind that I mentioned before. Either talking about sexuality historically in the relationship was an invitation for anxiety and panic and criticism. So, yes.
I imagine that you might be listening and hearing this scenario and then thinking, okay, that's not great communication, but I don't understand how consent might be lacking. You, Jeremiah, had an aha moment during your sex therapy training that helped you to understand what was problematic about this and about how this dynamic with your ex-wife was lacking in consent. So what was that aha moment?
It was the first class, actually, that I took at South Shore Sexual Health Center's program. It was about the ethics of sexuality, where we learned what's called the Plicit model.
Ah, any good sex therapist knows Plicit. I could say Plicit in my sleep.
So in summary, for those of you who are unfamiliar with this, the Plicit model is an ethical practice used actually in nursing, but since adopted by sexual health professionals and other mental health professionals, for slowly talking with clients, in this case, about sexuality.
From an ethical perspective.
From an ethical perspective, right. It's an acronym of sorts. The P stands for asking for permission. The LI is limited information. So talk only about the specific thing that's being brought up. Don't get too big too quick. The SS is specific suggestions, meaning provide suggestions that are specific to the topic at hand. And the IT is intensive therapy, should there be a need for longer term treatment.
So as you're learning about this model for ethically engaging with sexuality, what were you thinking and feeling as you were learning this?
I was shell-shocked after the first class because I thought, fuck, I haven't been asking my ex for permission to have sex. Of course, I was also so stuck in the emotional cycle and protecting my ex at the time that I didn't have the wherewithal to realize the larger societal context for our relational interaction. But in the particular class, I internalized this. I thought, well, shit, this is marital rape.
Oof. Let's just pause here for a second because this is super, super loaded. I am generally not someone who is shy about really any sexual health conversation. But as I was considering this episode, I had my own experience of, oh, fuck. We're moving into marital rape territory. Jeremiah, as a point of connection, I can vividly remember exactly where I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan during my sex therapy training when I had the realization that the sexual experiences in my marriage were not always consensual either. But for me, I was on the receiving end, I suppose. My circumstances were not all that similar to your ex-wife, but I was in her position, for lack of a better way to say it. the outcome was similar. I was engaging in sexual experiences that I did not want. I also had a very similar thought process. I thought, is this marital rape? Is my partner sexually abusing me?
So to be very clear, marital rape happens and is a gross violation of a person's human rights. In straight relationships, this can look many different ways, and the church has fueled marital rape with their misandrous and misogynist rhetoric around men's sexual urges and the wife's duty to care for her husband's sexual needs. This is an intentional abuse of power.
Then there are other situations in which non-abusive patterns still contribute to non-consensual sexual experiences. I repeat, in this section of the podcast, we are specifically referring to what happens when unhealthy yet non-abusive dynamics lead to non-consensual sexual experiences, which was true for both of us.
Yeah, I'm aware, Julia, of both how interesting and also how sad it is that we've both found ourselves on different ends of this equation.
Asking ourselves, are we raping our partners or are we getting raped by our partners?
Yeah.
That was such a jarring, disorienting situation, especially being a sexual assault survivor.
Sure.
To wonder if that was happening in my marriage was panic-inducing.
Yeah, yeah. How are you feeling as we're talking about this?
In this particular moment, I am fine. I've been thinking about this episode a lot.
Yeah.
So before we recorded at different points over the past week in thinking about this, I was less fine, but the dialogue that we're having feels supportive to me.
Yeah.
I hope it feels supportive
to totally, you. Oh, totally,
totally. I'm considering that the rigid scripts that we both learned about gender actually set us up to enact these patterns around non-consensual sexual experiences.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And then a sexual experience happens by, in a straight context, both people playing out those gender roles, as opposed to talking about what it is that they might like based off of their like individual needs or quirks or interests or fantasies. Yeah. You mentioned a minute ago, Julia, that this episode was really, really hard to plan for in advance. I'm sure that there are some difficulties that are coming up right now. Can you talk a little bit more about what about this episode was hard for you to prepare for?
So many different answers to that question. In absolute transparency, I feel protective of you and I feel protective of my ex. Neither of you are abusive people. You are two of the best people and the best men that I know. So when I reflect on ways that both of you engaged with your ex-wives in non-consensual ways, I want to come to your defense.
Yeah.
Because I know that both of you were actually doing your damn best.
Yeah.
At the same time, I also don't want to minimize my own experiences either, or the experiences that I hear from so many clients have quite a bit of grief around the years that I spent having sex that I didn't want.
Yeah.
So here's a controversial take, and I imagine many people may disagree. I think we have to stop treating all non-consensual sexual experiences as abusive or as an intentional abuse of power.
Tell me more about what you mean by that.
If we are to consider a non-consensual sexual experience as an experience in which one or both parties, or however many people are involved, not wanting to have the sexual experience, we must allow space that multiple different scenarios could lead to someone having a sexual experience that they didn't want. Mm. And not all of them are a result of abuse. However, they can be problematic, harmful, unhealthy, even without an abusive root.
That's really interesting, Julia. Yeah, tell me a little bit more about this.
I also wonder if it's helpful for me as a woman to say that. Sadly, I have survived abusive experiences in which men have abused different forms of power to hurt me sexually. These experiences are inherently different than the experiences I had with my ex-husband for the first couple of years that we were married. I participated in the unhealthy dynamic that led to those experiences with my ex-husband. Now, I am not victim blaming here. I absolutely did not participate in the dynamics that led to the abuse that I survived.
Yeah.
I did contribute to the patterns of sex with my ex-husband in which I was having sex that I did not want to have, and I was having sex that I did not enjoy.
Yeah. How are you doing right now? How does it feel to reflect on that?
I'm really sad. I'm sad that neither you or I knew any other ways of engaging sexually.
Yeah.
The most heartbreaking part is that we were both trying hard to be the best partners that we could be. And the patterns that developed from our best efforts, which were modeled to us by Christian culture and Christian leaders, were strong contributors to our divorce and set the stage for both of us to have years of non-consensual sexual experiences.
Yeah, definitely.
So, Jeremiah, tell me a little bit more about what happened after that first sexual health class when you had your aha moment.
There are also situations like me and my ex where the shaming messages around sexuality completely shut down one partner. In my case, the female partner in an opposite sex relationship. And the other partner's put in a double bind. Initiate a conversation about sexuality and expose my partner to a panic attack, which I easily had 50 experiences of throughout my relationship, rooted in a combination of the church's teachings about sexuality and her unwillingness to address the harmful messages of the church. Or don't initiate a conversation about sexuality and either lose sexuality altogether or find more passive, gentle, but also less consensual and conversational ways of initiating sex. As I've come to learn over time in my own processing of this, the phrase marital rape misses the complexity and double binds that both partners are in.
Specifically when referring to these dynamics.
Correct.
Not in the dynamics in which one partner is intentionally abusing their power.
That's correct.
What's interesting, Jeremiah, is that avoiding consent actually put you in the position of a more gentle way of sex, which is interesting.
Yeah. Right, because I learned more so in my marriage and also working in mental health that men are the sexual aggressors, to use the language that you used earlier.
Right.
And the last thing that I wanted to do was to cause any sort of pain, any sort of hurt to my ex.
Right, and the reason I mentioned that is so often when we think about non-consensual sexual experiences, first, we understandably jump to experiences that involve rape or assault. We forget that many other dynamics occur and that some non-consensual sexual experiences are far less assertive than abusive interactions.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally does. Yeah. So go back to what you asked about initially. Within a week of the class, I had a conversation with my ex in which I said, hey, I need to apologize to you for the ways that sex has been happening. I haven't been talking with you about sex. I've just been kind of beginning to make out with you. You've kind of been going along with it. That feels really icky. That's not the sex that I want to have. I imagine that feels really gross for you too. Will you forgive me? And she said, yeah, sure. Yeah, don't worry about it. And I responded, hey, what's that been like for you? She said, oh, it's no big deal. Don't worry about it. So that dynamic completely threw me off.
Wow.
So not only when I sexually initiated, but also when I emotionally initiated hard things, I wasn't able to get what I wanted or needed, which at the end of the day was relational connection.
Also not something that you were given permission to seek in or outside of the church.
Right.
You learned that men crave this animalistic, non-relational forms of sexuality.
Absolutely.
Huh. I am so sorry.
Thanks. Thanks, I appreciate that.
That is really painful.
Yeah. Thanks. It's incredibly painful. I had several people make comments after I got divorced. Hey, Jeremiah, you seem like a completely different person. You seem more confident. You seem more positive. And those comments have stuck with me. And I thought for some time that it's like, yeah, because I was in like such a shit relationship. But I'm sitting more with right now this idea of I had so much of my own shame in my relationship that's rooted in this conversation of, am I a marital rapist or am I not?
Yeah.
And being out of that relational context also removed me from having to deal with that question. Once I started a relationship with you, we had our kind of initial sexual experiences. Those were really, really healing for me, partially because you and I, like very early on, did a lot to talk about the sexual experiences that we wanted to have. And we can talk in another episode. We'll come back in the fall to conversations about infidelity. We'll return to an element of this conversation then. But for this conversation, I learned in my initial sexual experiences with you that I'm a good person.
Mm.
That my sexuality and my worth as a human being are not like diametrically opposed ideas.
Right. So you had different data points to suggest that you could express sexuality and express desire in a way that wasn't threatening, in a way that wasn't violent. Right. And that your sexuality could be desired and seen positively.
Which leads into more confidence in being able to negotiate a sexual experience with you. The more confident I feel in myself, the more able I am to talk with you and for you to talk with me about the sexual experiences that we both want, which creates a different kind of mutually reinforcing cycle.
Mm. And also, clearly I'm really great at sex. So that seems like a wonderful way to end our episode. Thanks for that validation. But actually, no, seriously, I have some parallels there as well. I, for different reasons, did not feel desired in my marriage, in large part also due to these unhelpful scripts about sexuality and gender. That being said, thank you for sharing about some of these very hard experiences for you. We have more to say, but this has been heavy.
Yeah.
And perhaps you need a break. Perhaps some tea or a walk or banana bread would best serve you.
Or if you're me, bananas on crackers. In Europe, there are, what are they called?
Digestives.
Yeah, Europe has digestives, which are these super yummy tasting, basically like graham crackers. And so
I don't like graham crackers.
And I will chop up bananas and put them on top of digestives. And those are my pretty much daily at this stage afternoon snacks. So
yeah. I think I'm at a strange point in my menstrual cycle in which I intensely crave salt, and I always crave salt, but before we recorded this episode, I literally heated up broth, this very, very, very salty plain broth, and dumped a bunch of Parmesan cheese in it, and half spooned, half drank that. So I am going to get something salty to soothe myself, do what you will to soothe yourself after joining us for this wild ride of consent.
And
we're not done.
And we're not done. Yeah, come back next week. Next week, we will talk, Julia, a little bit more about your story. We'll turn the tables. I will be the interviewer. Julia will talk about her experience. Are you excited?
No, I'm not excited. But you mentioned something about tables, and one of my favorite phrases that I always want to use is, my, how the tables have turned. I don't know if I've ever said that in real life. I want to, though. I want to be in a situation in which I can say that. My.
So,
or That's how the cookie crumbles.
So we'll talk a little bit more, Julia, about your
about
experience.
My favorite phrases.
We'll talk a little bit more about our own relationship and how we have learned to unlearn some of the negative messages around sexuality and practice consent in more active, intentional ways. And we'll also do some Relationship 101 in the next episode. So that will be released next week. Anything else, Julia, that you want to say before we pitch our Instagram channel?
You can pitch our Instagram channel.
Here it goes.
I stay far away.
To learn more about Sex Evangelicals, visit us online, www.sexevangelicals.com. We are in the midst of a little bit of a rebranding process. A huge shout out to our teammates, Nicole and Shelby, for doing an amazing job in coaching us and continuing to support this podcast in the ways that y'all are. You can also follow us on Instagram, at sexevangelicals. We have other social media pages that are not getting love right now. Maybe they'll get love in the future. Have a great rest of your day, wherever you are, whenever you're listening.
All right, let's keep healing together. Bye.